I had given him Fred's address, knowing that he would be helped and encouraged there. Such is the confidence we can have in some brethren. Though I little expected that he would be round there quite so immediately, I recall the amazed comment of Brother Fred, "That young man certainly believes in jumping in at the deep end." A little later, he and his girlfriend were both baptized at Portsmouth, to our great joy. It is sad to think that neither are any longer members, but it is interesting to recall that it all started off from our understanding something about the apocalypse. I have sometimes thought that we do not credit others with an interest in these more difficult books and tend to assume that we alone are interested in them. How wrong we may be. In connection with my job as a careers advisor, I occasionally had to attend meetings of social workers from different disciplines at which various speakers gave talks on their particular type of work. On one such occasion, the speaker was a young Anglican parson whose talk was intriguingly entitled, "Going In With The Milk." He had been given the task of starting up a new church on one of the large housing estates recently established by the Basingstoke Development Corporation, and was told that when he had got a congregation, the church commissioners would build him a church. In the meantime, he was housed in a large caravan which served as a church for services and also as a Sunday school. He began by getting together a small band of dedicated helpers and holding Bible study and prayer meetings in their homes, arranging as far as possible to have one such house meeting in each square. The development of the council houses was based on squares of homes grouped round a central green. It became then the responsibility of the leader in each area to watch for new arrivals, and as soon as somebody was seen to be moving into a new house on the estate, they would knock on the door and introduce themselves in a friendly way, asking if there was any way in which they could help the newcomers to settle in. Information about local services, bus times, schools, library, etc., are often helpful in such circumstances, and thus a contact was made from which to go on to invite the newcomer to their Bible study group and later to take part in the work of the church and become themselves eyes and ears to contact and help others. That was why he called it "Going In With The Milk," because milkmen and other tradesmen are well known to adopt this method of offering their service when new people are seen to be moving in. He considered that the church should be as on the ball as the milkman, and surely he was right. At the time he gave his talk, he had got together a weekly congregation of around 60, and after we left Basingstoke we learned that he had achieved the target set and the Church of England had built the promised church. I admired that young parson for his enterprise and zeal. Unless you should think him a paid hireling who was making a good thing out of his religion, a quite customary and ill-informed attitude among Christadelphians, I fear. I should add that when giving out our own handbills on one occasion, I came across his home with the vicarage on the gate. It was in fact a small council house, exactly like hundreds of others on the estate, and I wondered how many of those who condemn the clergy for accepting wages for their work live in such modest homes themselves. My experience is that the number is very small. Our customary attitude to a paid ministry has no basis in Scripture, for Paul has laid it down that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel, 1 Corinthians chapter 9 verse 14, etc. We may charge that the clergy do not preach the gospel, but that they receive their livelihood from those to whom they minister is perfectly scriptural. The fact that we prefer to have an unpaid ministry is the collective wisdom of the community, having seen the evil effects that can result from the introduction of money rewards into religion. In these days, however, it is a fact that most parsons could make more money in secular employments than they are paid as ministers of religion. And we should be very careful in making wild assertions about the paid hirelings of the church. In the case in point, I hang my head in shame that this young man established a church in a council estate while we only made 2 converts in 5 years in the same town. The other thing of particular interest in our Basingstoke days was the gospel rally, which was organised by the Newbury Ecclesia shortly before we left. It arose out of an Arranging Brethren's meeting at which the discussion centred on what we could do by way of a preaching effort of a different kind. At that time, marches were the order of the day for promoting any cause, and I had a conversation with a teacher in one of my schools about this then new phenomenon. He was a communist intellectual agitator, very unpopular with his headmaster, but we had discussed religion on several occasions without coming to blows. He made a comment which had stuck in my mind. "You can't make any impression these days without going into the streets," he said. "You've got to get out and demonstrate." I suggested to the Arranging Brethren that we might have a go ourselves and try to organise a march through Newbury, calling on the populace to return to God in the expectation of the return of the Lord. The idea caught on and fired the enthusiasm of the small meeting to a degree which I have seldom, if ever, seen before or since. Unfortunately, however, the police authorities were unwilling to allow a public demonstration in the centre of Newbury on the Saturday we had requested, but said we could have it in Thatcham, which is a large village about 3 miles out of the centre. We settled for this and booked a very large marquee to be erected on the village green, the village hall for a mini exhibition, and every member of the ecclesia got involved in some way in the preparations. There were posters to prepare, leaflets to be stamped, sandwich boards to be made, loudspeaker apparatus to be obtained, and all the other things usually associated with Bible campaigns. Even our elderly sisters took part in some aspect or other in the preparations. This was to be something bigger than anything we had before attempted. It was more than just another campaign, it was a gospel rally to which we invited ecclesias far and near to come and join in. At one stage in our preparation, it became apparent that we were not going to have enough money for all the things we wanted to do, and I had to report to the Arranging Brethren that we would have to curtail our ambitions somewhat. This was quite a blow, as the whole Newbury Ecclesia was behind the effort and had already given generously to pay for it. That night I went home to Basingstoke somewhat downcast, to think that our plan should be frustrated for want of money. But the telephone rang that same evening, and a brother from another meeting was on the line to say he had heard on the grapevine that we were doing something unusual and would like to give us some financial help. Like Nehemiah, I felt this was more than just chance, and told him how we were placed and what had taken place at our planning meeting. "How much do you need?" he asked. "I can give you £200 now and more if you need it." Remembering that £200 was a lot of money in those days, you may understand why I felt quite overwhelmed, and thanked God and took courage. It was more than enough to keep our plans and finances on an even keel. And we were so grateful to the Lord, who had put it into our brother's heart to make such a generous and spontaneous offer, just when we needed it. But why did it happen? And how did he come to ring me at the very moment when our plans were being embarrassed for lack of money? Needless to say, I very soon rang round to my colleagues to let them know the good news, and Brother Nelson Ball, known to many for his kind heart, but not noted for his extravagance of expression, told me afterwards that when I told him the good news on the telephone, he went cold. I know what he meant. There are not many times in life when you feel the almost physical presence of God. When the great day arrived for the gospel rally to take place, it was wet. Not just a damp morning, but a thoroughly soaking day. After all our preparations, we were to be met with, quite literally, a wet blanket. Nevertheless, we were committed and began to assemble in the marquee to take out the leaflets, man the exhibition, and join in the procession, carrying banners on poles with Christadelphian slogans. To our joy, we were joined in the work by up to 200 brethren and sisters from many other places, as far afield as South Wales and the Midlands. It really was a rally of gospel preachers, and heartening in the extreme. And as the weather slowly improved, the spirits rose, and the occasion became one which remains in the mind of those who participated. In fact, when visiting the ecclesias in South Africa, 6 years after, we were confronted by a brother and sister in Port Elizabeth, who greeted us with, "How did the gospel rally finish up?" It appears that they had been present among the 200 helpers before emigrating to South Africa. They actually called it, somewhat irreverently, Lens Dem. It would be pleasing to relate that the effort was a roaring success, but in truth the number of visitors to the meeting in the marquee in the evening was very poor, though we had a very good response from the children of Thatcham, who not only took part in the competition in connection with the Bible exhibition, but actually begged us to start a Sunday school. This was later done, through the dedicated work and cooperation of members from Newbury and the Reading Ecclesia, and a good Sunday school and youth group resulted, which led eventually to the removal of the Newbury Ecclesia to Thatcham, where they have now obtained a nice little hall of their own, far more suitable than the old auctioneer's room. So, some permanent good did come of the gospel rally, but by that time we ourselves had moved on. Chapter 8, Preaching Abroad. I have always thought of myself as a piece of flotsam, being washed around on the sea of life, and certainly the metaphorical expression of the apostle has been literally verified in my own experience, that here we have no continuing city, and we found ourselves on the move again. A promotion in the careers service led to Hereford, and I've already been longer in this city than any place in which I have lived throughout the whole of my life. It is a largely unspoiled part of the country, famous mostly for its bulls and its cider. The ancient cathedral houses what is claimed to be the finest chained library in the world. Among its treasures is a copy of the Bible called the Cider Bible, because in the passage in Leviticus 10 verse 9, where in the authorised version Moses is commanded to tell Aaron not to drink wine or strong drink when you go into the tabernacle, the word cider is substituted, presumably by some translator from Herefordshire. The ecclesia in Hereford was very small, almost non-existent, when the late Brother George Merritt went there soon after the war, as catering officer in the county hospital. His work in nursing and building up the church which is in this place is legendary, and I have found in ecclesias in many parts of Britain that as soon as Hereford is mentioned, George Merritt's name comes up immediately. there had been a steady growth of numbers, both through baptisms and removal, before we went there. And when we arrived in 1972, the ecclesia numbered between 40 and 50, composed for the most part of brethren and sisters from South Wales and the Birmingham area. They had obtained a hall of their own in a former Methodist chapel, which had been converted for its use as a Christadelphian hall by the labours of the members themselves. Brother and sister Leonard Bedwell had moved into the area around this time, and he was recording brother when we got there. He had done a long stint of service in Middlesbrough and had now retired to the peace and quiet of the West Country, so was able to offer considerable experience to the growing ecclesia. In the last few years, numbers have grown still more, with several able brethren and sisters choosing Hereford as a place to which to retire. There are now about 70 or 80 Christadelphians there, where once was only George Merritt and a small band of helpers. Such is the way of life in our ecclesias. They seem to have their zenith and their nadirs, almost like human beings, often seeming to go through the cycle of growth, a platform of maturity, and then decline. One thinks of the thriving ecclesias one has known in the past, which are now either non-existent or a pale shadow of what they once were. What happened to them? They appeared so strong and permanent, but like human beings, they too got old and their strength waned, and they died. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. Our life in Hereford is too recent to provide much in the way of nostalgia. We had no sooner got there than I found myself making weekly journeys to London to speak at the London Bible Study class, which was being held each autumn in the Friends Meeting Place in Euston Road. While living in Basingstoke, I had promised to give 10 studies there on the early church, and as all the arrangements had been made, I felt unable to pull out. So, Ingrid sharing the driving, we had to do a round trip of 270 miles every Monday for 10 weeks, from Hereford to London and back, a total of nearly 3,000 miles. A transcript of the talks was later published under the title The New Testament Church and the 20th Century Ecclesia, Comparisons and Contrasts. They are now out of print, though I still get requests from time to time for copies, which I'm unable to supply. Whatever the merits or faults of the subject matter, it was an honest endeavour to see how near or far we are from justifying the claim so often made that Christadelphianism is New Testament or Apostolic Christianity revived. We too easily quote Bertrand Russell, affirming that our body is probably the nearest to original Christianity among modern sects. He was, after all, a pacifist. Without referring to the same writer's assessment of our general ethos as having much in common with the Nazis and communists in its disregard for other groups. I suppose it would be true to say that the only bit of Russell most of us have ever read is the oft-quoted sentence above, and with almost everything else he wrote, we will probably disagree. But that, of course, is human nature. A year or two after going to Hereford, I received an invitation to speak at a conference in Melbourne, Australia, and to spend a month visiting the other Christadelphian ecclesias in the other states. This may therefore afford an excuse to give some brief reflections on what we saw of the truth in other parts of the world. We had already been to America and Canada from Basingstoke in 1969, visiting the Bible schools at Idlewild, California, and Vernon in British Columbia. There is no doubt that such invitations give a wonderful opportunity to see places and meet people thousands of miles from home, which for most of us, certainly Ingrid and me, would otherwise have been unthinkable. For the speaker, it is far from being a paid holiday, for the amount of work put on him is often quite absurd. I suppose it is a case of the man that pays the piper calls the tune, and I have never had any feeling of being hard done by on any of these trips. It is an expensive business bringing speakers from the other side of the world, and natural enough for the organisers to get as much service out of them as possible. It usually entails giving 40 or 50 addresses, with a great deal of travelling in the space of a month. But the advantages are certainly not all on one side, and the speaker, and often his wife too, is rewarded by excellent opportunities for travel, and also the chance to meet some very beautiful people. In any case, viewed only as a service to the Lord, it is a very great privilege. We were saddened to find in America the same spirit of division already referred to. Indeed, it seemed even more prevalent there than in Britain. The great divide was between the amended and non-amended fellowships, though in truth I found it difficult to be sure which was which. One of the most interesting and sincere brethren we came across at the Bible school was, we discovered, on the wrong side of the fence, and therefore, although he and his family took full part in all the studies, they could not break bread. It was the same old story. I ventured the opinion privately that the best thing they could all do was to get together and accept that they had slight differences in the abstruse matters in question, which need not divide them into two factions. I soon found that such easy solutions were not acceptable, however, and found myself hauled up before the Bible school committee, who wanted to indoctrinate me into the differences, lest I should say the same things elsewhere. So there they were, the committee on one side of the table and me on the other. I remember I said jokingly, "And when did you last see your father?" A reference to the famous picture of a small boy being interrogated by the Roundheads in the Civil War. But it was lost on our brethren, who only wanted to tell me about the causes of their own little civil war. I regret to say that I told them I was not very interested in their local squabbles, as I had come only to preach God's word and will continue to do so to the best of my ability with his help. They were a little disconcerted that I would not let them inform me on the matter, but I think they probably bore no grudge, though I was never invited there again. The incident didn't detract from a very happy time, however, and we made many new friends there. We found our American brethren an exuberant bunch, with an apparent superabundance of energy. After the week-long Bible school, we had to go on a tour of Disneyland and Hollywood, which we found an exhausting business, though it is regarded as a must by all Americans. After an afternoon spent in a whirlwind of activity in Disneyland, we finished up at the Los Angeles meeting room, just in time for me to pull on my formal shirt to address the Bible class. I was literally doing this as we pulled up outside the hall. From Los Angeles, we flew on a whistle-stop tour of the ecclesias on the West Coast, San Francisco, Washington, and on to Victoria and Vancouver in British Columbia, at both of which I spoke several times before going on to the Bible school at Vernon, a distance of about 400 miles from Vancouver. We were impressed by the huge distances our American friends are prepared to travel to attend these Bible schools, for there were several from various parts of Canada at the Californian school, and likewise from California at Vernon. In some cases they must have motored 1,000 miles or more to get there. In Britain we think we've done rather well if we travel 100 miles or so. Another thing which impressed us, especially at Idlewild School, was the primitive conditions in which the attenders live. They sleep in what can only be described as huts, in some cases without even the light inside, and with communal sanitation. They look to us very like English chicken houses. My own theory is that our American brethren, whose incomes and standard of living are way ahead of most of us, enjoy roughing it for a week in the summer as some kind of masochistic penance. Because we were speakers at the school, I suppose, we were housed in a much better chalet, which we shared with Brother Edward Whittaker, who was the other English speaker. What a happy time we had together. Our rooms were separated by the single washroom and toilet, so we had to make an arrangement that when one used it, he locked the other's door, to prevent him getting in and causing embarrassment. It was great fun. Edward was very popular at the Bible school, for his musical talent helped him to organise a musical evening, which they enjoyed very much. I'm sorry to say that apart from speaking duties, I had no talent to contribute, apart from a certain newly acquired enthusiasm for volleyball, which was played on some afternoons. I had never played the game before, so was building the daily news handout as a secret weapon of the over-40s in their contest with the under-40s, or was it married versus unmarried? I forget now. Anyway, by a stroke of luck, we won, apparently for the first time. I felt I had not lived in vain. In Victoria, I was billed to give a special lecture, which had been widely advertised on the subject, The Greatest Takeover of Them All. It was at a time when takeovers in the commercial world were making the headlines, and obviously was a vehicle for preaching the coming takeover of the world by Jesus Christ. The local newspaper did a write-up of it with a splash headline which read, Christadelphians Gather, Huge Takeover Planned. It sounded quite ominous. Vancouver was a lovely city and we stayed with lovely people, Jack and Ruby Martin. Jack was a veterinary surgeon, and his great hobby was collecting articles on various biblical subjects from every kind of source in the history of the Brotherhood, and collating them under subject headings in loose-leaf book form for easy reference. He actually wrote out each article in minute longhand, which was then photocopied and distributed to those on his mailing list. This provided a ready reference on most topics of what had been written by different brethren throughout the world. It was a monumental task, and one which should have been very useful to those interested in Bible study, but it seemed to me at the time to be too much physical effort, taking up most of Jack's spare time. The resultant reference book certainly deserved a wider circulation, and I've often wondered why it has been neglected by those responsible for our publications. There were one or two unfortunate brushes in my stay at Vancouver with some sisters who held a very hard line on some matters which should be left to individual judgment. This is not at all uncommon in Britain, but the divisiveness over such things seemed to be more widespread than in England. There was an endeavour to get me to pronounce on a matter of divorce which had arisen, to which I gave the same replies in California, i.e. that I had not come to get embroiled in local problems, the details of which were not known to me. In any case, one only hears one side of such domestic disputes. The other argument was over the question of teaching our children to pray, and it was asserted that they could not be so taught, as they were outside the bonds of the covenant, as the saying is. I was expected to give my support to this proposition, which to me was unthinkable, and so I had to reject it quite clearly. Ephesians 6 verse 4 and 1 Corinthians 7 verse 14 are surely apposite in this connection, which led to the dear and earnest sister fleeing from me with the accusation that I had destroyed her faith. But what kind of a faith is it that can be destroyed because somebody believes it right for children to learn to pray and that their father and ours listens. I later gave an address in the Vancouver meeting room, planned before I left England, but happily suitable for the situation, entitled "The Need for Moderation," based on Philippians 4 verse 5, "Let your moderation be known unto all men." And one of the sisters, at least, had the good grace to come to me afterwards and acknowledge that she had been converted, though for how long I know not. We had a happy time at the Silver Star Bible School at Vernon and met some very interesting folk. On one free afternoon in the week, we had the pleasure of being taken by Brother Bartholomew, Bart as he was known to all and sundry, for a trip into the Rocky Mountains, which we found very enjoyable and impressive. He was a great character, who has done a lot for the truth in that part of the world, though he was very inclined to the conservative views of some of the Australian brethren, which were creating a chasm among the believers in the New World, as witnessed by the discussions in Vancouver referred to above. We had a long and frank talk about the situation on this journey, and I was pleased to get a letter from Bart after returning home, in which he stated that he had been impressed with some of the points I had made, and intended taking them up with the Australian brethren concerned. But I never heard what the outcome was. Some brethren object to the use of terminology such as liberal and conservative in relation to attitudes in the ecclesias, but even if undesirable, they are a convenient shorthand to describe the different points of view that inevitably manifest themselves in every community, be it religious, political, or social. There will always be those who want to go too far or too fast, and those who don't want to go at all, but stay where they are. The first century church had its conservatives, who wanted to keep to the old paths of the law, and others who had scant respect for their scruples and felt emancipated in Christ. Paul's attitude was to condemn them both, if they refused to allow freedom to the other to serve the Lord according to their own consciences. They were both right, the one in his scruples and the other in his freedom. But in judging another man's servant, they were both wrong. See Romans chapter 14. We should learn something from this. It was our privilege to go to Australia in 1974, after we had moved to Hereford, and we came up against the same intolerance there which was causing the trouble in America and Canada. The Melbourne conference was again a great success, and we met something like 1,000 very happy Christadelphians with whom we enjoyed good fellowship. But the absence of members of the extreme right wing was noticeable, as it had been whenever our English brethren had been invited there. I met 3 brethren at the conference, who in thanking me for my talks and expressing pleasure at being there, also stated that they had been ordered not to attend, as is customary on such occasions among this group. They objected to being told where they should or should not go, and were delighted to have been able to enjoy the week-long studies in God's Word. 2 thoughts arise from this. The first is this. What kind of a theology is it which has to veto members from listening to another point of view? And the second is this. When members actually do break away from the party line and listen to the other, they find that things are not what they have been made out to be. There can be lessons for all of us in this, perhaps in regard to our own attitude to other Christian believers. One of the pleasures of being in Australia was to meet up again with Brother Kevin Murphy, whom we had met some years earlier when he visited England. He was lead clarinetist in the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, which was housed in the famous Sydney Opera House. He came into the truth in Adelaide, where he played in the Adelaide Orchestra at the time, through the instrumentality of Brother Arthur Bone, who also played in that orchestra. Together they got others interested in the Bible, and made, I believe, three or more converts in the orchestra. Kevin got the lead in the Sydney Symphony Orchestra after his visit to Britain, when we first met him at the West Hendon meeting. He had done some polishing up under the guidance of the world-famous clarinetist Jack Brymer, and was auditioned for the SSA on his return. When we were with him in Sydney, he had converted his mother and father, his brother and sister-in-law, his own wife, and two or three others, and had six copies of Alan Haywood's book, God's Truth, circulating among members of the orchestra. What an enthusiast! He had talked to Jack Brymer about the truth when in England, and asked me to get in touch with him and send him some literature, which I had done, but without getting any response. When I reported this to Kevin, all he said was, "Ah well, you win some and lose some." We stayed in Australia some 4 weeks and visited most of the ecclesias. The distances involved are enormous, and communication between ecclesias in the different states has to be infrequent for this reason. So the biennial conference is a great get-together, and they come from distances of up to 2,000 or 3,000 miles to attend. We were very impressed with the spirit of cooperation manifest in this conference, and came away with a feeling that we in Britain have a lot to learn from them. There was a lot of friendly rivalry between the various states, as for example in the preparation of their Bible exhibition, which was combined with a special lecture in the Melbourne City Hall. Each state was allocated a section of the display to prepare, but because of the great distances involved, it could not be brought together until the conference began. So it was quite exciting for each to see what the others had made, and a lot of thought and imagination had gone into it, as each group was determined that their bit should not let the side down. In the event, I thought it one of the most professional and interesting efforts of this kind I have ever seen. Similarly, they have a nationwide competition among the brethren and sisters to produce a new conference hymn for each occasion. Some of these may be words only, set to tunes already in use, while others are compositions of both words and music. The one that is selected as the conference hymn is then used at the conference, whilst the others are printed in a separate booklet. I am not very musical, so cannot pronounce on the quality of the tunes, but they seemed extraordinarily good to my unpracticed ear, and showed a remarkable degree of talent. We felt that the brethren and sisters we met in Australia were less inhibited and formalised than in Britain, and we were impressed by the number of young people at the conference. They put on a musical evening for the benefit of their elders, which was very swingy, yet done with great reverence. It is only a personal opinion, of course, but I wish we could be less formal and a little more spontaneous in Britain. It might even help to bridge the generation gap here, as well as giving more freedom of expression to the spirit. As I have kept my excursions abroad limited to 4 yearly efforts, it was 1978 before we went again, this time to South Africa, which proved to be my Waterloo. For I got some kind of chest infection there, which has stayed with me since, and limited the amount of speaking I'm able to undertake. Nevertheless, it was a very happy experience, and again we were able to visit almost all the ecclesias there, as well as speaking 3 times a day at the Durban Bible School. There are only about 600 brethren and sisters in the whole of South Africa, and they are very thin on the ground in most areas. Many of them attend the Bible Week, which provides a link between the far-flung membership. At the time we were there, they also had a Christadelphian aeroplane, which was used to keep contact with their isolated brethren in the bush, as well as for assisting small ecclesias to hold preaching efforts. What a joy and a thrill it was to fly in Mission Air, as it was called, to break bread with a farmer 200 miles out of Durban. Brother Anthony Oosthuizen piloted the tiny aircraft, and for one exhilarating moment he let me have a go at the controls. So, for the first time in my life, and no doubt the last, I had a joystick in my hands, though I'm not sure that the other passengers got much joy out of the adventure, and I was too terrified to enjoy it. It was a good experience all the same. Our visit to this troubled country gave us the opportunity to see something of the hated apartheid policy of the Afrikaans government, and we were allowed to visit one of the black townships, for which it's necessary for whites to get a permit. A brother who worked as a government official fixed it for us and took us round, though it's difficult to form a proper assessment of the situation in so short a time. The black population seemed to be quite happy, and a Zulu lady to whom I was introduced, living in one of the thousands of tiny brick-built detached bungalows which the white government had built for them, and whom I asked how she liked her new home, replied in the typical Americanese with a broad show of white teeth, "I dig it." We should think these standard rabbit hutch homes very cramped, but when it is remembered that many of the black, in this case Zulu, population had come in from hovels or beehive homes in the countryside, it can well be imagined that they find them quite delightful. These things are all relative. In Britain today, people have got accustomed to having nice homes and a comparatively prosperous standard of living. But many of us who are older can well remember times when many of our brethren and sisters would have been very pleased to have a little home like these in the black township, with light and heat and running water, and a little bit of garden all round. Most of the Christadelphian homes we stayed in were, of course, of a much more opulent kind, and all employed black servants, rather as in Victorian England, every middle-class home had its servants, even if only a little maid-of-all-work. It is expected of the white population, who give employment in this way to thousands of blacks who would otherwise be unemployed. Brethren in Bible mission work in the West Indies have found the same social pressure. We discovered no trace of resentment among those so employed, and the attitude of the white employers appeared to be that of benevolent patronage, as it used to be among good employers in England, until the education of the masses and the influence of socialist agitators made Jack as good as his master. So it will undoubtedly be in South Africa. The wind of change, to use Harold Macmillan's phrase, is already blowing, and the deeply religious Afrikaans government are really engaged in a King Canute exercise in trying to keep the old order going. What amused and to some extent amazed us was that our brethren and sisters there seemed in the main, though not entirely, to favour the present set-up and fear the coming change. I recall a dear elderly sister of a rather aristocratic type lamenting that there was a time when the blacks would step aside when we came along to let us pass, but now they are as likely as not to push us off the path. She obviously preferred the deferential black population of the disappearing past to the brash types we saw driving their big cars loaded with grinning pickaninnies. I finished this South African tour with some difficulty due to the increasing problem of the chest infection, which had also affected my voice. I had given about 50 public addresses in all, and the strain was beginning to tell. So we were not sorry to catch the jumbo jet and fly home, although it had been one of our most interesting trips, and the brethren and sisters were most kind.